Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The latest U.S. Census showed that nearly half of American homes use natural gas furnaces for heat. That's going to have to change for the Biden administration to meet its goal of reducing greenhouse gas emissions to 50% below 2005 levels by the end of the decade. Heat pump technology could help. Sam Kalish is an engineer and scientist spreading awareness around electrification and decarbonization. He's the head of special projects at Rewiring America, and he occasionally dresses up as a heat pump, apparently, to talk to people about electrification. Sam Kalish, welcome to All Sides.
Great to be here, Ann.
You've experienced this firsthand. A lot of people don't know what a heat pump is. Can you describe it, how it works?
Sure. Yeah. So heat pumps aren't really that complicated. They're basically like an air conditioner, which takes heat from inside your house and puts it outside in the summer so that your house stays nice and cool. But they can run in reverse, too. So in the winter, it can go and gather up the heat that's available outside and concentrate it into your house. And so replace the functionality of your furnace in that way, but it doesn't require any fossil fuels to run, so it can be zero emissions.
I don't get how they can gather heat outside in the winter.
It's kind of counterintuitive, but it's through the same kind of science that runs your refrigerator, the same way that we can create a cold box inside your house. We can do the same thing by harvesting heat using a refrigerant and bringing it in and raising its temperature to something that's comfortable to be around.
Why? And as far as the carbonization goes, you still need electricity for that, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But the electricity wouldn't come from coal burning, for example.
Yeah. So if you look at the data, state by state and sort of grid by grid, pretty much everywhere in the country, it's a win in terms of emissions to switch from burning a fuel directly to using a heat pump that's driven by electricity, even if gas is used to create that electricity. And it's also important to recognize that this is only a snapshot of the grid today. Any heat pump installed is gonna have a useful life of 10 to 20 years. And if you look at the trajectory of the grid, it's already greening a lot more rapidly than people think. Roughly a third of states get the majority of their electricity from clean sources already today, and that number grows year over year. So it's in this way, heat pumps are kind of like an appreciating asset. They're already a win in terms of emissions, and they just keep getting better.
But they're expensive to install, right?
So it's important to like place this in the context of your household infrastructure as it is. So you have heating in your house, and it has a useful life. So at some point in the next, 10 years or something, it will probably break and you'll have to replace it. It's important that we're emphasizing people don't need to run out today and rip up their house and buy a heat pump. They just need to be ready for when their heating system or when their air conditioning system goes out, that then they're going to install a heat pump. And then if you think about it that way, the heat pump actually serves a dual purpose. It replaces both your heating system and your air conditioning system. And so compared to that, it's actually less expensive in almost all settings. And for those houses that don't have air conditioning, it's only maybe like a few thousand dollars more expensive on top of an already $10,000 to $20,000 expense to replace your furnace that you already are going to spend. So in that way, it can be a little more expensive, but it's not as much as kind of most people have in their heads. And especially now that we've got this legislation, the Inflation Reduction Act, in place, there are a lot of incentives that can help buy down that small difference in upfront price and actually make it the more affordable option.
Does the heat pump disperse the air the same way as the gas would, so the ventilation system would be intact?
So there's lots of different kinds of heat pumps. You should pick the one that is compatible with your existing source of or a method of air handling in your house.
Okay.
If you have forced air, you get a heat pump that plugs into your forced air system, basically. But the simplest kinds of heat pumps are called ductless mini splits. And those can go in, extremely easily, and they just have a small unit that mounts up on the wall. And it just kind of exchanges the room air and provides heating and cooling that way.
And you do it room by room.
For that case, yeah, you can do it room by room or kind of zone by zone. These indoor units, they can handle a couple rooms.
Okay.
So I just did this at my parents' house in Indiana. And we have four indoor units spread throughout the house. And for a house that I grew up there, and we burned wood for heat, and I've never been there, and it's been more comfortable. It feels luxurious, to be honest.
I remember we were looking at a house many years ago, probably over 20, and it had a heat pump. And when we had somebody go through it with us, they said, "Nah, they got a heat pump. Yeah, you don't want to go there. It's a hassle. They break down. They're not good. They aren't efficient." So tell us about what the downside of heat pumps are, or was, and how that's been addressed by the industry.
So yeah, thanks for the question. This is something you hear fairly often, and it's important to recognize that heat pumps have undergone a relatively revolutionary change in technology in the last 10 years. So it is true, 10 years ago, you would have heat pumps that didn't work a lot of places. They pretty much were used exclusively in like the South Atlantic, where they had really mild winters and you really only had a small amount of heating load and temperatures didn't get down that low. But there've been a couple technical innovations in like how a heat pump works in the last 10 years that have made it possible for them to operate in extremely cold temperatures, down to negative 15, negative 20 Fahrenheit. And for that reason, they're being installed in places like Maine, Minnesota, Alaska, and people are really happy with them. So technological progress is a big reason for this. And they've kind of reached this point where they're not only viable in terms of providing heat in these climates, they're actually the more economic option when you add up the cost of the electricity to run it versus the cost of the gas or the fuel oil or propane that you're using. It actually saves you money month to month.
If I want a new HVAC system, I know exactly, you know, right off the top of my head, three or four people or companies that service and offer that. I don't hear about heat pump companies. Where do you get them from?
Yeah, so you should call those people because they probably install heat pumps.
Okay.
You know, you might find that two of them are very familiar with heat pumps and two of them maybe aren't or might try to talk you out of it. And that's a little bit of the holdover from 10 years ago where they didn't work that well. So at the install I just did at my parents' place in Indiana, it turns out our neighbor is an HVAC tech, and we talked to him and he came over and set us up with some lovely heat pumps. So yeah, you won't find heat pump installer in the yellow pages, but under HVAC technician you should find them.
And as far as the new housing, you know, hopefully, I guess a lot of people are talking about, you know, we need more housing in this country. What do you know about how the new housing construction industry is embracing heat pumps?
Oh, it's like gangbusters. For new construction, it's not only the cheapest option up front, but it's the cheapest option ongoing as well. So for people trying to provide low utility bills to the people that are moving into the house, for the people building the house that want to cut construction costs, this is it's a hands down winner.
You talked to lawmakers in Washington about the importance of heat pumps and electrification more generally. The Inflation Reduction Act you mentioned, which President Biden is expected to sign today, by the way, includes billions to help people. He did sign it, or he's expected? Yeah.
Very exciting.
Yeah.
He's expected to sign it later today.
How does the money, the billions they say is in that to help people upgrade their home appliances, how do you know, or what do we know about how much of that will go to something like heat pumps?
Yeah. So actually, we're about to release a tool on our website, rewiringamerica.org, to help people answer exactly this question so they can put in their zip code and their other information and figure out what's going to be available to them, how they get it, and when they can get it. But I'll give you the quick version right now. Mm-hmm. So the Inflation Reduction Act pumps up an existing tax credit for home improvement, and it allows up to $2,000 for a household to claim against their taxes if they install a qualifying heat pump over the course of the tax year. And then there's additional programs on top of that. Say if you're a household that is below a certain income threshold, you can get up to $8,000. And for that one, you don't have to wait until you file your taxes. It comes right off your bill. So you don't have to front the money for it at all. And so especially for households that need help defraying the upfront cost of something like that, the programs like this are available.
I know there are people listening around the country, but most of them are in central Ohio. Is there a heat pump for, you know, your typical northern city amid climate change that is better than others, a type of it?
So depending on your climate, where you are in the state, you might consider what's called a cold climate heat pump. This is what I installed in my parents' house. There are, you know, there's not one particular brand these days that's better than the others. They kind of all have pretty good offerings. You want to look at the SEER rating on it. But you know, your contractor will help you with this. They'll help you pick the right one, basically. Mm-hmm.
And then you talked about those the subsidies that might be available. How much does a heat pump cost? I mean, can you give us a range?
Yeah, so this will vary a lot depending on kind of what your house looks like, how much work is happening to the house. But you know, if you consider the cost of replacing your existing furnace, maybe that'll run you like $10,000 or something. That's something you're already going to spend. If you know, obviously depending on the details, if you were going to do a heat pump instead, maybe it'll be like $12,000 or $15,000. So an incremental cost on top of it, to be sure. But you know, sort of a bit on top of an already existing large chunk.
And the cost of running a heat pump is cheaper.
So this again varies based on your local electricity price and your local gas price or fuel oil price. But in the vast majority of households, it is cheaper ongoing.
Just because electricity is cheaper?
Well, it mostly because the heat pump is so darn efficient. It just doesn't use that much electricity. And so there are some places in the country, Michigan, for instance, has a relatively expensive electricity price and a relatively cheap gas price. And heat pumps do struggle to make like economic sense there. But in almost all the other states, like Ohio, it's a hands down winner. Like almost every household in the U.S., in Ohio, it's cheaper to run a heat pump.
Huh. Well, Sam Kalish, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. We'll put a link to your website so people can check out those, check out how much subsidies they would be qualifying for.
Lovely.
All right.
Great chatting.
Sam Kalish is an engineer and scientist spreading awareness around electrification and decarbonization. He's the head of special projects at Rewiring America. And again, we'll put that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides for your information. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Ford on Monday unveiled vehicle headlights that can display images on the roadway ahead of the vehicle. The company says that the technology can enhance safety by projecting speed limit or weather information onto the road. Mercedes-Benz debuted similar technology a couple years ago, but it's never been made available on a mass market vehicle. Managing editor for commerce at CNET, Russell Holley, has been following the story, and this is a special day because we have Russell for two segments today. Welcome back, Russell Holley.
Thank you.
So, all right, I'm trying to think about how this works. What does it look like?
So when you think about, you know, kind of pictures being projected in front of you, a lot of times you think about like a movie screen or, you know, maybe you've seen some of those like futuristic car concepts where, you know, there's just a lot of animation going on here, but all of this is actually happening with the headlights. So what you would want to visualize there is like a slightly brighter section of the headlights in front of you on the road, that are showing very simple pieces of information, like perhaps an arrow pointing to confirm a turn signal, or very simple but large numbers to confirm speed limits and things like that. Not a different color or an animation that could interrupt someone else driving towards you, but a slightly brighter spot on the road where you'd be able to see some of that information on top of the, you know, or area that's already lit up by your headlights.
So is it like stencil-y looking, like it's kind of cut out?
Yeah, it's got a bit of a stencil-y look to it. You know, the overall goal there is to give you just really little bits of information in very simple graphics.
Mercedes-Benz has used the technology, but as if Mercedes is mass marketed anyways, but it wasn't used in a mass market vehicle. What did they learn from that experience though?
Yeah, so a big part of the kind of lessons learned here when trying to have this information shown in front of you is it has to be very simple, but it also has to be big, you know, in order to give you the information without distracting you from the actual act of driving. If the text is too small and you're too focused on reading it while you're driving, that's really unsafe. Mm-hmm. So instead of having, you know, either a lot of text or you know, kind of small icons, they try to occupy about a full third of your lane as far as that simple image goes. And they're presented out a couple of feet in front of you. And it's just very simple. Like if the roads are potentially icy, there's an image of a snowflake, mm-hmm. you know, kind of on the road in front of you. It's not that different from the simple icons that you would see on your dashboard, just made really large on the road for you to see as you're driving.
Why is this seen? Is this an advantage? I mean, what do we know about why this is helpful?
So you're already looking there. You're already looking out on the road as you're driving. And so having that information presented there is safer than having you constantly glance around at things that are on your dashboard. There have been a lot of lessons learned from Subaru and other companies that having that sort of constant beep notification to encourage you to look at your dashboard is actually not the safest thing in the world. And when you add in, you know, all of the different things that cars are doing now as far as lane guidance and speed monitoring and things like that, all of those things try to give you sort of different notifications and warnings and things like that, which is very helpful from a safety perspective, but it can also be quite distracting when you've got all these different things going on, especially if it's a car that you are unfamiliar with. And so, you know, making sure that these work as functional rental vehicles as well is just as important, especially for a company like Ford, whose cars are a major part of rental fleets across the U.S.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I mean, that's when you want to know the speed limit, for instance, when you're new to an area, you're driving in an unfamiliar place. Does the size of the headlights change? Would the size change, or are they the same size?
That's actually a really interesting question. There's a conversation right now about trying to change an old law in the United States about how headphones are allowed to behave in
headlights. Right? I guess,
what's that?
You said headphones.
I'm sorry, headlights.
Okay,
my brain is clearly somewhere else right now. You know, there's a really old law in the books about headlights not being able to, about the kind of, you know, how bright a set of headlights can be and the uh-huh. general purpose that they can serve as far as being able to cover certain areas. And this has actually set United States vehicles back slightly as new forms of headlights have been designed. And there are actually really smart headlights that can be used in Europe that are designed to do things like bend with you as you turn on a road in order to make sure that that you're able to see everything on a sharp turn and stuff like that. Those headlights are slowly becoming more legal here in the United States. And so this is kind of a first step towards a great deal of changes that will likely be coming to headlights in cars over the next 10 years.
That's interesting. There's a law that dictates how headlights are supposed to work.
It's a really fascinating old law that from any of the research that I could do suggested that its original intention was to keep high beams from distracting horses.
How about me keeping them from distracting me?
The law is, and it's just never been changed.
I'd love a high beam that would automatically go to low beam when you're approaching another car.
There are actually several cars that do that. It's an automated technology. I know that Subaru, for example, has it in a lot of their cars where it's an automatic high beam. And when it detects light from any source coming towards it, it will automatically dim. It's not super intelligent. I have it in my car. And every once in a while, if I'm on a highway that has really bright lights from above, it is enough to turn off those high beams. A lot of those technologies are things that are being developed right now.
Interesting. After the bad 2021 for Peloton exercise equipment maker, They laid off 2,800 employees in February. More recently, they announced plans to eliminate an additional 784 jobs and end plans for a $400 million factory in Ohio, by the way. What's going on at Peloton?
Peloton is having a rough year, and a lot of this is actually some really confusing messaging. The announcement came that that's very nearly 800 employees were going to be let go, and that a whole bunch of stores throughout the United States were going to be closed. A lot of them in malls, with very simple kind of demonstrations that you can go and set them up. And anecdotal as this evidence may be, I know that the little Peloton store in the mall near me almost never has anybody, you know, on a bike or on a treadmill anymore. It was when it first opened, there were people pretty excited, but it's been quite some time since I've seen somebody other than the person who worked at Peloton sitting in that little store. It's also really important to point out that in the time that Peloton has become popular, a lot of companies have implemented very similar pieces of technology in their indoor bikes, but have also lowered the prices. Whereas Peloton is actually looking at increasing the price of its Bike Plus and its Tread models. There are a lot of competing products that are considerably less expensive and offer very similar services, which is just not a great sign for Peloton and its continued future. At the same time, Peloton kind of stars, the folks who are actually leading the classes, have this almost celebrity following across things like social media, and have actually been doing things like tours in places all across the country. I'm not terribly far from Washington, D.C., where several Peloton bike instructors were here recently. And at first, I thought that there was actually a protest happening near the White House, when it was in fact a visit for these Peloton celebrities. There were hundreds of people that were here to see these people and take selfies with them. So it's really fascinating. The following for Peloton's products for people who already own them are quite popular, but there's just not the growth attached to it.
Peloton seems to be wanting to charge more while other companies are coming in with comparable products and charging less. But all things being, across the board, the demand has to be going down because of the pandemic.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, there's just not as many people working out at home,
yeah.
The desire there is considerably less. There are a lot of people who look at, almost $3,000 for an indoor bike and notice that it is nice outside and that a bike that they could ride outside is considerably less than $3,000. There's a lot of different things that contribute to that. And, with gyms now fully opening back up and other classes, it's not hard to say, it's cheaper for me to spend, $20 a month on kind of your standard gym than it would be to have a $3,000 bike in your house.
And the other companies, do they have these kind of, outlets at the malls like you were describing earlier?
No, not at all. No, these are almost entirely online stores. You might every once in a while run into like a Bowflex store in a large mall or something like that, but usually it's attached to some other, retail experience, not having that sort of standalone. One separate important call out is the company Beachbody, which is extremely popular in California. One would describe it almost as cult-like in some cases, as far as its popularity, specifically in that region for going to a physical gym and having those classes. They released a separate standalone bike that's actually quite good and has a lot of those same, kind of classes that you can pay for to have in addition to being able to just sort of ride wherever you want. There's a lot of competition for Peloton, and it's pretty easy to compete on price in a lot of those cases.
So for folks who did invest in a Peloton bike, what do they need to know about the company's prospects going forward?
So it's important to understand that even if Peloton were to announce tomorrow that it is completely shutting its service down, Peloton bikes are still really good. They're some of the best as far as their physical build. So if you already own a Peloton, it's not like those services are going to go away anytime soon. It is important to highlight that Peloton, not all that long ago, started selling just the software for the Peloton service that you could use on any bike. And that's actually been pretty popular. It means that if you already own a Peloton, it's extremely unlikely that the workouts are going to go away anytime soon.
So you're safe.
It's definitely something that, for at least the next year, it's extremely unlikely that anything would happen to people who already own a Peloton.
I think when I heard someone talking to someone about buying a Peloton, and they said, oh, well, what if you go out of business? And they said something like, well, there's something like thousands and thousands of stacked workouts.
Absolutely.
That you can
turn the software, you know, you can choose to do that sort of live workout experience if you have that, but it is not in any way a requirement.
What are your thoughts about how Peloton is reacting to this at this point with the layoffs and so forth? Is there a concern about customer service?
Absolutely. So Peloton has a shaky history of customer service as it begins with. You know, I'm reminded that when its, you know, treadmill service first came out, they tried really hard to squash rumors that it had run over several children because of a safety feature that had been missing.
That's right.
There aren't a ton of experiences when it comes to an indoor bike where you need to, you know, hop on the phone with customer service, but you know, it is something that should something break on your bike, it may become increasingly difficult for those services to happen without some sort of extra cost associated with them.
And long term, I'm just kind of curious about your thoughts about the at-home workout versus the gym or the outdoor experience. I mean, there's a lot of benefits to doing an in-home Peloton or, you know, stable, you know, what am I trying to say? Indoor bike experience as far as fitness goes.
Yeah, I mean, indoor bikes existed well before Peloton, and they are certainly going to outlive the company. This is a really well-designed sort of indoor trainer that is perhaps not worth its high price tag, but it's still a really great piece of equipment. But even if this company were to fold tomorrow, there are a lot of different options for doing this same workout very safely in your home. And it's still really the best option for people who live in areas where there is more than one season and you cannot get outside perhaps every day of the year.
Or remotely and don't near a gym or whatnot. Yeah. Let's move on. You wanted to talk about near field NFTs in Hollywood. Near field technology.
Man, I wish it had something to do with near field technologies. Oh. No, this is this is considerably less exciting. It was pointed out very recently that there are several Hollywood producers that are working on entire television shows and movies based on art that was found from NFT collections.
Tell us what NFT collections are.
Yeah, NFTs are you know, they're art forms that are attached to the blockchain, which means when you own it, you own the only version of that thing, and you can, in theory, prove that you have you are the only person who owns that thing. It's a pretty hot topic of discussion as to what that ownership actually means. If you have this piece of art and someone takes a picture of that piece of art and that picture is good enough for them, then it doesn't really matter that you have this token that says that you are the owner of it. It kind of decreases in value as soon as you own it, because it doesn't, you know, it does, it, the act of ownership only matters as far as the other people who acknowledge that you are its sole owner. The act of, you know, having this conversation about blockchain and whether, you know, art on the blockchain is something that is important is entirely separate from the number of artists who have tried to release unique forms of art through this medium. There are a lot of different, you know, artists who have contributed to NFT art. And if you try and separate the concept of NFT from the art itself, you come up with all of these really unique, you know, kind of characters and art forms and, you know, different animations. And it is through that art that we have found several Hollywood producers and writers creating experiences based entirely on these NFT collections.
Well, what do they do with it? I mean, I don't get it.
For the moment, the way that this works is that now that this person has this digital ownership of this piece of art, they can create a story around that piece of art and make a show based on it. And a good example of that is this piece of art called Forgotten Rune Wizards. So there are it's a silly name for a thing that is, you know, a collection of about 10,000 fantasy characters that all have their own little backstories and unique, you know, things. And John Wick creator Derek Kolstad is a fan of these animations and was enough of a fan of them to create an entire series based on these characters and some adventure that they may or may not go on. You know, so as far as the person sitting at home watching this Netflix show that may, you know, release in kind of the not so distant future, you would never know that this came from an NFT. You know, all you would know is that the creator behind John Wick made an 8-episode animated series that features wizards and other fantasy characters going on some sort of adventure. The thing that is significant there is that the digital ownership of the characters that show is based on introduces a potential new legal challenge for anyone who would do kind of the standard fan-based art around a series like that.
Okay.
You know, so if you think about, you know, Marvel superheroes and you know, the most recent, you know, Sandman series on from Neil Gaiman, the thing that happens anytime a show like that comes out is there is suddenly all of this art that is created by third parties. These are not people who have licenses to create art. It follows, you know, loosely some fair use laws, but if you go to, you know, Etsy or something like that, you find all of this art in various forms made by people who are just fans of the show. And for the most part, a lot of those companies allow this to happen because it's in many ways free marketing. You know, if someone is creating all of this art for Iron Man and it doesn't really benefit you to stomp on the person who is selling them for $5 a piece because other people are using this to express their love of this character that you're already making a fair bit of money on. NFTs kind of changed that a little bit because there is now this sort of digital form of ownership of this character. And the now, you know, it's not about Netflix possibly going and saying, hey, you can't make this art. The person who now owns the actual original animation, which in this case would be the actual writer behind John Wick, would potentially be able to pursue that on his own and be able to reach out individually and shut those things down. There's no immediate inclination that that's going to happen because the series doesn't exist yet. But the fact that this all comes from an NFT raises this sort of unique and fairly new potential legal hurdle for things like fan art.
So art on NFT, is it typically animation or is it all kinds of stuff?
NFTs can be an enormous number of things. I think I've seen someone make an NFT out of a photo of a receipt from a place that they went once. Really, it is anything that you can attach a digital code to as a mechanism of ownership and place it on the blockchain as this permanent sort of global identifier that you own this thing. But it can be just about anything.
Once you own it, can anybody else see it?
Anybody else can see it and do really pretty much anything with it. It is a common almost joke on social media that I have taken a screenshot of this thing that you paid $10,000 for, and
right.
I didn't have to pay $10,000 for it because I now have a screenshot of it, and it's the same picture that you have. That, you know, this goes pretty deeply into the concept of you know, how art has value across the world. It is because there is a group of people who have deemed that it has value and have attached a monetary number to what that value is. NFTs are looked at in very much the same way.
I mean, I know people who don't post their art anymore because they realized it was being stolen.
Oh, absolutely. There are a lot of, you know, kind of traditional animation artists and photographers and a lot of different groups that will only publish their art in places where people can observe it in a way that they can't capture it and repurpose it, because there are entire companies that are based in, you know, a lot, most of the time, not the US,
right,
that will take those images and immediately put them on T-shirts that people can buy. I don't know the last time that I have scrolled through Facebook and not seen, you know, some T-shirt advertised to me and wondered if the company trying to sell that T-shirt to me is the actual creator of that art.
We'll be right back with more with Russell Holly. He is managing editor for commerce at CNET. So stay with us. A little bit more Tech Tuesday coming up. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Still with us, Russell Holley, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET. Thanks again for joining us, Russell. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Google has launched an ad campaign to address texting issues between iPhones and Android devices. I've definitely come across this. Why do these issues exist? Mm-hmm.
For two reasons. One, it benefits Apple financially to allow these allow there to be this divide between iPhone and Android when it comes to sending text messages. And two, Google is historically really, really bad at messaging. And you can tell this by the fact that there have been almost 10 different messaging clients in the last decade and change that Google has tried to encourage its users to adopt for messaging people.
So Google doesn't just have its own messaging.
Google, in fact, has several and has phased out a whole bunch throughout time. You know, I guess it was about 12 years ago, Google had this idea that text messaging was sort of dead. And if everyone had this sort of unique online identifier, then you could just message that person through that unique online identifier. You know, instead of worrying about whether that person, or whether you knew that person's phone number, if you had an email address or their text message handle or, you know, something like that, then you could just message through this non-text service. I think at one point it was called Google Chats and then Google Hangouts and Meet. And it's had several, I think Allo was another name. It's had several iterations over the last decade. But the concept up until quite recently was, you know, if we create this alternative to texting, then there will be no more reliance on the cell phone companies and whether they can reliably deliver that messaging. Unfortunately, in the meantime, while all of that was happening, Apple created one of the best and most stable text messaging systems that has completely dominated at least the United States and most of North America. And while that was happening, Europe and Asia switched to a separate online service that wasn't reliant on Google or Apple called WhatsApp, mm-hmm. Which ironically is now owned by Facebook.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah. When I've traveled, I've used WhatsApp. Why does Apple whip one out and it's, you know, mind-bogglingly good and Google's going through them like, you know, a pack of gum?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, a lot of this comes down to Apple's iMessage service was not originally very good, but it was a text messaging service and it worked the same way on every iPhone. And so if all of your friends had an iPhone, then you had this reliable mechanism for messaging everyone. And there were some features that could be added on top of it that worked quite well. And Apple has just continued to push that particular cart, where as long as everyone had an iPhone, you had all of these features. And that's been Apple's method of operation for as long as the company's been along. If you have an iPhone and a MacBook, the two communicate much better together than they do if you have a Windows laptop. If you have an iPad and an iPhone, then the two work together much better than they do if you have an Android tablet. Apple has this sort of walled garden method of operating. And because Apple has been tremendously successful at selling its hardware, that ecosystem has thrived. Google has not been as successful at doing the same thing. There are a lot of people who own an Android phone and a Windows laptop, or an Android phone and a MacBook. And so there's never been that kind of unified cohesion between all of its constituent parts, unless you ran Google services on top of everything, which not everyone did.
So what is this ad campaign saying? I mean, what are they, just whining about it, or what are they
Google,
saying?
Yes, this is essentially Google whining. Google has been working for the last 2 years on a set of text messaging services in coordination with Verizon and T-Mobile and AT&T in order to create a service that feels similar to the product that Apple has released. The it relies on Apple and AT&T, I'm sorry, it relies on AT&T and Verizon and T-Mobile to all kind of cooperate and to do things the way that Google has set them out to do. And it's only recently become fairly successful in its ability to offer features that are very similar to what Apple has been able to offer. But that divide between Apple sending a text message to another Apple user and Google user sending another text message to an Apple user still exists. You know, the dreaded green bubble. If you are in a chat with iPhone users and you have and you are the person who has a green bubble, then you are shunned and mocked and you know, kind of relentlessly teased in some circles. And so Google has for about a year now been kind of slowly like, hey, you know, if Apple would play along, then things would work better. But there's no monetary benefit for Apple to play along. A big part of its entire marketing system is, if you have an iPhone, all of these things just work better. And that includes messaging. So, you know, there is no technical reason for iPhones and Android phones to not be able to send text messages and have them work together, but it does not benefit Apple in any way to alter its systems to be friendlier to Android phones.
You know, Google blames these issues on Apple for not adopting modern texting standards. And it sounds like, I don't get that, because you just said if you have an iPhone, all of this just works better. So what is this modern texting standards about?
Google invented a modern texting standard that Google created, and then reached out to Verizon and AT&T and T-Mobile, and they adopted those technologies, and they work in some international services as well. And now that all of those services are up and running, they can now release this marketing campaign that's like, hey, Apple, why are you so behind the ball? But that's just not even close to what this looks like. Google is the one that has been playing catch up for some time now. And while it would be nice for Apple to adopt some modern technologies in order to ensure that there is not this dependence on carriers in order to send messages, it doesn't really benefit Apple to do so. And shaming them is certainly not going to help.
And then as far as what's going on in Europe, WhatsApp, I mean, how's that working?
So, you know, WhatsApp has been explosively popular across Europe. There are an enormous number of places where WhatsApp isn't just the way that you send messages, but it's also the way that you pay for things. It's the way that you kind of store messages. It is the group chat that your family is in. In many ways, it's also a social network. You know, there's actually been quite a few reports in non-English countries of WhatsApp groups being used as a mechanism for political advertising. That is especially true in Spanish-speaking communities here in the U.S. WhatsApp was a pretty substantial mechanism for communicating during the last election and trying to you know, kind of encourage family members to vote a specific way. It is used very differently depending on what community you are in and depending on what culture you are a part of. But it is this behemoth of a communication service, and that is why Facebook worked so hard to acquire it. And now that Facebook has acquired it, there's been some efforts to adjust its own messaging system to behave a little more like WhatsApp and try to monetize WhatsApp in kind of delivering advertisements and things like that. And it's just not been super successful, but there's so many people using it that Facebook or rather Meta, as it is now referred to, can still claim it as this tremendous success that, you know, makes them a ton of money just by existing.
Are you adjusting to the reference to Meta versus Facebook now?
I try so hard not to. I think Meta is a really terrible name. Facebook acquired this company called Oculus that made VR headsets, and they had this headset called the Oculus Quest 2 that they have been selling for a little over a year. And in the middle of its release cycle, the company decided that it was now called the Meta Quest 2, and they released all of these advertisements that say, hey, it's the Meta Quest 2. The box that I bought it in still says Oculus Quest 2 on it, so I still refer to it as the Oculus Quest 2. I'm sure that at some point in the next, let's say, 6 months, I will eventually break and refer to it as Meta before referring to it as Facebook. But today is not that day, Anne.
Okay. There are better and not so good ways to charge your iPhone. I've learned this the hard way when I've lost my new charger. What's the difference? Why did they change it?
So, you know, every time that there's a new iPhone that comes out, there's some, you know, kind of underlying new technology. And pretty frequently, some of those underlying technologies include charging. Over the last couple of years, the charging hasn't been so much the port down at the bottom that you plug the cable into, but the actual kind of underlying stuff that allows it to charge faster or more efficiently. And it's, you know, both your laptop and your phone, really at this point, regardless of who your manufacturer is, has these little tiny computers in the actual charger part that communicate back and forth with your phone in order to adjust how much power is being delivered one way or another. And this is a challenge because a lot of folks will buy an iPhone and they'll, especially now that Apple doesn't include a charger in the box, and they'll just use the charger that they already have. Mm-hmm. Even if that charger was from 5 iPhones ago, or, you know, even 3 iPhones ago. But those chargers are slower and they're not as smart, and they actually can, in very small ways, damage your phone over time.
How so?
Because they're not charging as quickly or they're charging too quickly. Your phone really operates best, especially with some of these new high capacity batteries, if that first 50% can be charged really like as quickly as, you know, as much power as can be pushed from the wall to your phone, that first 50% doesn't matter a whole bunch. Once your phone is charged beyond 50%, it actually matters a great deal how much power that phone receives as far as how long your battery lasts. Not how long your battery lasts from one charge to the next, but how long your battery lasts over a course of 3 years or more. And there are a lot of iPhone users who are keeping their phones beyond that sort of standard 2-year mark because they can. The phones are still working. They're still great. But the first thing to go in most iPhones is the battery. You know, all of a sudden you're on, you know, year 4 of your battery of your phone, and suddenly your phone is only lasting 4 hours instead of its, you know, sort of normal 8 or 10.
So it's called a lightning charger, right? The one new one,
yeah,
that comes
the cable
with
is referred to as lightning, but the thing that it plugs into in the wall, that little brick,
that's different.
Has changed quite a bit. Yeah. There are some that you know, kind of that standard charger. Really, if you look at your iPhone, if you have an iPhone that you have bought in the last, say, 3 years, and the end that plugs into the wall isn't shaped like an oval, if it's shaped like a rectangle, you should replace that cable and replace the little thing that's plugged into the wall as well. That oval is the same thing that powers a lot of laptops now. It's called USB Type-C, and it delivers power a lot more efficiently because it has that little computer in it that I mentioned that will help determine kind of how much power is going from place to place.
Yeah, I found my new charger. I lost it for a while, and I was using old chargers, and they do take a lot longer, but I wasn't aware of the damage, the long-term damage to it. The same thing with the Apple Watch.
So it's actually a lot harder for your Apple Watch to be ruined because it's a way smaller battery, and the
okay.
stuff that's in it, you know, kind of doesn't have that same problem. But that same rule doesn't necessarily apply if you rely entirely on wireless charging from unofficial sources. You know, there are a lot okay. of different companies that make things that can charge your Apple Watch.
Yeah.
And it's important that, you know, when it comes to your Apple Watch, because the battery is so small, that you're using something that is actually approved by Apple to charge, because if it's approved by Apple, it has that little computer in it that is telling how much energy can be pushed from one place to the other.
Oh my goodness. So much. It's
a lot. It's really confusing.
It's overwhelming, but we have you, Russell, and that's all that matters, as long as we have you. Russell Holley, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET, thanks very much for helping us out today. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's, again, Russell Holley, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET. He's been coming on the show, Tech Tuesday, for a long time now. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.